Good morning. You're listening to author, activist, and journalist Cory Doctorow. And too much scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for May 16th, 2023. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. Chip, I had a wonderful week this week.
Well, that's great, Steve. Everyone deserves a wonderful week.
I went down to my high school and played my bass clarinet for the first time in 30 years for my band director who was retiring, and about 150 of my closest friends, all of us in our middle age, came in and played music for Greg Bim in Chicago Heights, Illinois.
Is this Mr. Holland's Opus, Steve?
That's exactly what this was. This is that guy. If Mr. Holland, that movie with Richard Dreyfuss, existed, it would be this event. This man is the center of the band scene, the marching band scene in the high school level for the last 40 years. And it was my privilege to go down and pretend that I know how to play the bass clarinet.
So when we write the movie, we have to pretend like we're John Hughes, though.
Okay, yes, this is a very John Hughes because of the Chicago suburbs.
Exactly. And then, you know, at the end, we'll have to let all the people who still have, Steve, do you still have detention?
Probably do. I probably owe a couple of detentions to that high school.
Well, maybe at that point, he'll just let you off.
Can you describe the ruckus?
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. You, sir, have been delving into the technology realm this week, and you saw the movie BlackBerry.
Well, now I am the subscriber to the monthly program for Alamo Drafthouse, Steve. That means I can go there every single day and watch a movie.
You are one step away from a stockholder at this point. This is your new favorite thing, is the Alamo Draft House in North Carolina, huh?
Well, I'm so sorry you don't have one near you, Steve.
Wrigleyville. I could drive to Wrigleyville, but that's quite a haul from the suburbs.
When I was in the suburbs, I used to be right around the corner from the AMC theater, and I had the Stubbs program, and then COVID happened. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that basically killed the AMC Stubbs program. We weren't allowed to go anywhere. And then I delayed getting a program. I explored the Regal program, but I decided the Alamo Drafthouse is where I was going to go because it is a place that really celebrates movies. Mm-hmm. And as I walked in to see BlackBerry opening night, they had the half hour of commercials, all the presentations, and anything you can imagine that Steve would like, mm-hmm, to set us up, because it was all about, this is what a computer is. With a VIC-20, you can do this.
So tell us about BlackBerry the movie.
This is a fake history of the BlackBerry. There's truth in it. Okay. Truthiness, if you remember Stephen Colbert talking a little bit about that. But I really think of like Jason Pargin, who used to write under David Wong. And he talked about that after seeing a movie, whether true or not, about a historical event, that becomes the history. Mm-hmm. And you can think about the implications of that, because filmmakers skew history to create a narrative. And if a person was there and they looked at it, they would say, oh, that didn't really happen that way. But anyway, it's enough truth that we should know about it. I just want you in your mind to think about any person you would think that would work at a startup with about a, I don't know, the BlackBerry is a cell phone, but just a computer company. Mm-hmm. And just think about those people. And if you had to kind of describe them, you don't need to say it out loud, but yes, that's exactly how they were portrayed in this movie.
Because give me a time period on the BlackBerry. Is this the late 1900s?
Sure, Steve. It's late 1999 or the early aughts.
It's right, right at the edge, the turn of the century is the BlackBerry.
So, you know, if we can just, you know, think about how it happened. We have no cell phones when Steve was a young boy.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have these massive, I don't know, bricks that you would carry around in a bag.
Or if you had a jacket pocket, you would put it in your jacket pocket. And every time it rang, you would take it out and answer, "Fox Mulder." No, that was just me. Okay. Yes, I actually did that. That was an actual truth of my life.
Well, anyway, they were massive. I don't know, shoebox size.
Yes.
Then we got smaller and, you know, they had, I guess they were just about the size of a brick. Then we had the flip phones. Obviously, we're in Chicago area. Motorola Razr, just a fancy, fancy phone. Phone to get.
Mm-hmm.
But the real innovation that happened with BlackBerry was they recognized there was unused bandwidth all over North America. And they could send emails over a network. They only could sell 500,000 of them, though, because it would overwhelm the network. And so part of the other innovation is figuring out how to add more subscribers, because they started a company and they have to make it. Now, these guys that you were imagining kind of working in their geek culture, they couldn't sell anything, Steve. So they ended up going out and getting this bulldog of a CEO who, I don't know, made it happen. But he was a real jerk, man. Just a total jerk. And he rode that wave. He knew what he had, and he rode that wave. He was trying to buy a hockey franchise during the time. The stock was at an all-time high. But really, I mean, these guys who were creating this BlackBerry, they knew it. They wanted a keyboard. They wanted it to be a quality product. It was the first of the cell phones that were sold as a status symbol. I mean, certainly the Razr could argue that, but truly it was a status symbol. They called them Crackberries. President Obama had to have his BlackBerry. And it was so important to him. The United States government had to figure out a way to make it safe.
Mm-hmm.
So he could use that those communication at the time. And then towards the end of our story, we have the release of the iPhone. And it just killed this company. So we went from, and by the way, the reason why the BlackBerry worked so well and was so secure is they ran their own servers at the time. And that was innovation, because you didn't have to download everything to the particular phone. It would be downloaded to the servers and it would be delivered to you in packets that allowed you to view what you needed to do. It really became, in fact, the salespeople had to go out to any place they felt they had the country clubs, the high-end restaurants, whatever, and the guy goes, "Just be obnoxious, use your cell phone." And imagine this. Steve, did you own a BlackBerry?
I did not have a BlackBerry. I did have that Motorola Razr that you mentioned. That was a hot big seller at the time. I didn't get into the smartphone market. I got in late, actually. I remember having...
What?
Yeah,
what? About that? Early adopter got in late?
Not on the bleeding edge of that technology. I had a few knockoff PDA-style phones here and there before the iPhone kicked in, and I didn't actually get an iPhone until they hit 4G on their capability for what they could send out here to the hinterland that I live in.
Well, let's go back to the cobwebs of your brain. Did you own a Palm Pilot?
I did not own a Palm Pilot. I had a cheap ripoff that worked in a very similar method as the Palm Pilot, but I'm a very cheap bleeding edge guy. I'm not the guy that buys those things on the first day.
Well, my first smartphone was the iPhone. And the reason ultimately I got it was because I got introduced through an iPod.
Hmm.
iPod mini, not even the full iPod.
Oh, wow.
So Apple's teaching me how to work around their ecosystem through a Windows-based iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Said, "Oh, this is real simple." And eventually I move over to an iPhone, and that was, I think I had the 3G, but it didn't matter. It was a business phone for me. and it had email capabilities. Really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
And the destroyer of this this technology that ran the world for a period of time. There is one of the founders who gets eventually pushed out and kind of loses hope in the company that we learn at the end sold his stock at the peak or near the peak. And he is one of the wealthiest people in the world.
Mm.
And he is kind of lost in history. So he's very happy who he is. And so we have a Canadian company, BlackBerry, certainly recognizing so much of what makes a quality product and a quality service. But ultimately, the story is how to quickly lose your advantage. And that is all around us. You're going to be seeing a lot of that over the next year or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's called creative destruction in, as economic terms. So as Sears goes away for Amazon, once again, just remember Walmart and Amazon may lead today,
mm-hmm.
but they could easily be gone tomorrow. So fascinating movie. I would say 65 out of 100. If you have interest in this, I would suggest going see it. This falls in with Pinball and Tetris as a technology movie that of a quick selling product. I'm thinking that we need a movie on the Palm Pilot now.
It's interesting. You have gone to a series of movies. I'm going to add Air to that as the list of movies that circle around a product of a certain era. BlackBerry,
sure.
Very interesting. I have been watching, no surprise to anyone, The Muppets Mayhem on Disney Plus. This is the sitcom based on the Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem band from The Muppet Show. That's as ridiculous a sentence as I will ever say. I love this to no end. The music that was created for this silly sitcom about puppets running around in a VW bus and making music, is it just speaks to me on such a deep level. The main theme is how performers become family, and the music is so engaging. Linda Perry is the one who's responsible for the music, and the album is available on all of your music systems. I just can't stop smiling thinking about Muppets Mayhem and the joy that it's bringing me.
So Linda Perry, many people would know from the band Four Non Blondes.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also a co-writer on a lot of pop songs. They bring her in to, she's usually female power type of music. What I will suggest, though, is my understanding of the, the Mayhem band, it was kind of like a jam band from the 70s. A lot of Grateful Dead, a lot of maybe Fish would fall into that. Is this music under those type of feelings?
Completely. This is so 70s. This is such that jam band vibe, and the whole story of Mayhem trying to create their first album. It's been 45 years and they haven't released an album, and they're trying as hard as they can to find the song to put into their album. And the modern artists who are a part of this are trying, and they're trying to give them the 2023 music. And they're like, no, man, that's not us. We're like, we're gonna have like our sound, man. Cheech and Chong show up. I don't know what that means for this group.
Well, Steve, think about maybe in the 70s, maybe on the set of the Muppet Show. It's probably a very, I don't know, relaxed vibe.
The vibe is the best word I can give you for this presentation. I love the bohemian ideal of these musicians traveling the world and forgetting to publish an album for 45 years.
So who is the target audience of this? Is it you?
Yes.
Or is it children?
This is a Gen X. This is building off of Jason Segel's The Muppets, where Gen X is absolutely the target audience. There's enough family-friendly conversation in this with the undertone, deep undertone of who these musicians are in relation to their creative process. But I am for sure the audience for this.
That seems to, Bob Igor had a conversation this week. I'm trying to figure out what he was talking about. He was talking about shows. And I'm going to suggest, and by all means, this hits you really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
This is indicative of what the challenge is with Disney Plus.
Agreed.
Because if you are a parent with young children, you're a millennial now. You're mm-hmm. not Gen X.
Correct.
And so if you're trying to like, well, we want to be able to talk to children, for my example, with entertaining parents, boy, this is a great example of the disconnect between where the entertainment should come with an app like Disney Plus. So anyway, very interesting.
I absolutely agree with you that the 1970s was a very long time ago, and these characters are stuck in that time period, and I'm here for it completely.
All right, Steve, you also got to look at a film on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, this is Judy Blume Forever. This is the documentary about the author Judy Blume and the generations of readers who really, really got what she was giving in terms of how society views childhood and maturity and that awkward stage in between. Now, I'm a middle school teacher, so I really understand that awkwardness of life in between. Judy Blume wrote books that really speak to my students.
So Judy Blume was an author, and it sounds like she started late in life.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to write books to answer questions that young people would have. One of the subjects could be sexuality, and also maybe how the body works. And so it puts her on the edge, even today, of what some parents feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's too bad, because she certainly did it with thoughtfulness.
The word care is very important to me. And I think that Judy Blume in this documentary demonstrates how she thought through how she should have this conversation with children, how children are really concerned about puberty and sexuality, and how they can have that conversation and give them the right vocabulary in order to be able to express themselves.
Tell me a little bit about the letters that she receives.
Yeah, there's some very touching moments in this documentary where she is connecting with people around the world. One young lady who is now not as young as she was 30 years ago, I don't know about you, but one young lady wrote Judy Blume letters over and over again throughout her entire life. And Judy became that young lady's diary. Like, she would write Judy Blume all of her, very emotional, very strong thoughts about life and what she's going through as a young lady. And Judy kept every one of those letters, and she takes them out of the file and she shows them and emotionally shares with the audience who this person is. It's a beautiful thought on growing up and finding out who you are.
So one of the real interesting ideas, if you were observing the United States and its population, is how comfortable we are with violence. Last week, we talked a little bit about Guardians of the Galaxy and about some of the scenes that, if we would move them from a comic book situation to a war situation, the devastation would be certainly horrific.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a very difficult time talking about sexuality. And what I mean by sexuality, I'm not talking about like explicit scenes. I'm talking about like how the body works.
Right.
And Judy Blume seems to have created a niche where she talks about it once again in an age-appropriate way
mm-hmm.
through a book.
And her books are still among the most banned books year after year. And a lot of the conversation in this documentary is that moment where we go, wait a minute, why are we banning this idea of how the body works? She is expressing in this documentary how she is flabbergasted that we are once again talking about banning books in the United States and how that impacts our society and our culture.
Well, it permeates so much. I mean, think about what's going on in Florida right now. Mm-hmm. And while that certainly is much more controversial and certainly much more on edge than what Judy Blume is talking about, it seems, once again, that sexuality is a very touchy subject, especially when families who refuse to talk about it with their children wish to control or ban children exploring it through the written word, through mm-hmm. the written word.
Yeah, this is a very poignant documentary. Judy Blume is such a lovely, lovely, happy, friendly author who in these interviews, in this program, is just joyous. I love the idea of having that person, that one special person who's able to communicate with young people on this level. I suggest this one to everybody.
Book it.
Brings us to our book it, our book of the week.
See, we have some special authors, especially authors, particular authors that you enjoy reading. So we have a new book by Cory Doctorow.
Yes. It seems like I have a very short list of authors that I keep bringing to the table over and over again. Cory Doctorow is one of those. He is very much a techno-thriller author. He's very technical. He knows a lot about how computers and communications work, and he's able to take that knowledge and make it into a very compelling adventure. This time, Cory Doctorow has released his new book. It's called Red Team Blues, and it's all about the secret behind-the-scenes action of cryptocurrency and the blockchain, and how there might be some intrigue and spies involved in that lifestyle.
So, is a book like this ultimately to teach you how? Through a story, how these things work?
There is some explanation of how blockchain works and how blockchain affects your life without you knowing it. But I wouldn't say that this is enlightening anyone. I think that you have to have some degree of knowledge of how those mysterious things happen. This is more about protecting yourself, creating a way for you to understand enough for you to keep your secrets, to keep your private information private.
Okay. And so what is the story about?
The adventure here comes with... Okay, so the main character, Martin Hench, is a 67-year-old, single, successful person who drives around California in a fully furnished tour bus. So I'm already smiling because I think back to the Electric Mayhem in their bus touring around, and I think of the lifestyle of that vagabond. This guy has been living that lifestyle for a long, long time. He's a self-employed forensic accountant. And before you get too excited...
Well, Steve, you're selling it so far.
Before you get too excited, his forensic accountancy really gets to the heart of all sorts of criminal matters where he is finding out where people are hiding certain wealth that they came about in a way that might be taxable, but they did not pay taxes on. I know this is a great adventure. It really is.
This sounds like a Phantom Menace, where we're going to be talking about an embargo, which is so fascinating.
This is much more like a Tom Clancy spy kind of story. This is an action adventure where Martin's life is in danger in so many situations in this book. It is a page turner. I went through this one very quickly. It's not as boring as I'm making it sound.
Well, you've sold me so far. Tell me more.
I really enjoy Cory Doctorow's ability to speak in words that I understand, but I'm not sure how many people in our audience would really understand. Truly, do I even understand blockchain and all of the ways that security happens behind the scenes? I don't know that I do. I love the way that he's able to use my very shallow knowledge and maybe add a little bit to it while giving me a real adventure where there's danger around every corner, there's intrigue, and the 67-year-old finds love in this story too, Chip. So this book has everything.
All right, first of all, Cory Doctorow is a fascinating writer. And yes, this seems interesting, but I just keep thinking, will Cory Doctorow break through and hit the mainstream at some point?
I honestly don't know that his stories will ever become that movie that everybody wants to see or that series that everybody wants to watch. I think that there's something underground enough about Cory Doctorow that I am intrigued to read every word that he writes. I like to think about all of these situations and like to think about how I could fit into these situations, but I don't know that everybody's imagination would go to that.
Do you recommend this to people who have interest in it?
To people who have a modicum of knowledge and want to visit the intrigue, I recommend this. I would not recommend this to anybody that I'm sitting next to. I think that there's an underground computer nerd piece to Cory Doctorow. Let me just put it this way. Will Wheaton does the audio narration for this book. So if you are a fan of Will Wheaton and you know his career, you are in a very, very special small band of people who understand where we're at with this.
We know Will Wheaton. I mean, he worked under Captain Jean-Luc Picard, Steve.
Well, I was going to say he was in Stand By Me, but that's all right. Yes, Will Wheaton being that kid from Star Trek The Next Generation and who has gone on to be just a symbol of the Gen X nerd. I knew you were going to say that. This is a very specific book, very specific genre. I enjoyed it very much, but I would not recommend it to everybody. But those of you nerds who are out there listening to the podcast, you might really enjoy Cory Doctorow's work as much as I do. That's Red Team Blues, published in 2023 by Cory Doctorow.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. There's some interesting things happening around town coming up here, Chip.
Steve, if you are in Elmhurst, Illinois, or Chicagoland, or want to travel to Chicagoland, and you like Marvel, like the MCU or Marvel Comics, looks like there's going to be an exhibit at the Art Museum, Steve.
Yeah, it's called Marvelocity. It is an Alex Ross exhibit at Elmhurst Art Museum. It's running all summer, opening on June 3rd all the way through August 20th.
If you are a person who is not familiar with Alex Ross art, you should go to our show notes, click through, immediately go, oh, yeah, we need to go see this. And the person who kind of put together the presentation of it, made the design, decisions on that, is Chip Kidd. And Chip Kidd is also a person who is well known for all sorts of commercial art on how to sell products. He's written books on using commercial art. He also does book jacket designs and things like that. And you are very familiar with him. When he teaches, you may know one of his, designs. It was the Jurassic Park design for the movie.
Oh wow!
For the book, for the book cover.
That is iconic for sure. Nice. Marvelosity, a study of all of that art at the Elmhurst Art Museum. I think that might be something that we could really spend some time and think about that amazing design.
Maybe we could record on site, Steve.
That's a good idea. Let's go over there. We're at an art museum. We'll have to use our art museum voices.
That's different from our theater. Yeah. Right. When we're thespians, Steve, we have to do thespian things. But when we're at an art museum, is one must talk about the attraction of this painting.
Then we should go record at a golf tournament once. Oh, he's on a par four. We're going to.
That was a beautiful shot there. It landed. I think
different voices.
I think he's ready to use the sandwich in this position. He'll be able to bring it right up.
Google I.O. happened this week as well. They focused mostly on their AI advancements. I think Google is truly frightened of what AI could do to their company and to their business model. I think that they see the horizon where artificial intelligence is going to really shape our view of search and how we find information in the future.
Well, certainly Jean-Luc Picard would just announce things. And things would just be answered, right?
And we're most of the way there, aren't we? Aren't we almost there where we have microphones all over our homes that are listening constantly for that key word for us to find new information?
Well, Siri still has troubles.
With your accent?
Trying to understand, Steve. You're like, oh. But you know who doesn't? Facebook. They seem to immediately know what you're thinking, Steve. All of a sudden this magic ad comes up. You go like, I was thinking that. I didn't even say anything.
I've had that happen where I did not do a search. I did not say anything out loud, but there is the ad for the thing that I was thinking about. That is downright creepy. The AI certainly is that level of creepiness right now. There's a lot of people that are looking at AI, not understanding it, first of all, and secondly, being fearful of what it could do.
Well, Steve, they have named their AI after William Shakespeare.
Yes, the bard is open to everybody now. The period of time when everybody was having to ask permission to use Bard is over. You and everybody else are now able to access Bard, Google's AI.
Does it speak Scottish, Steve?
It speaks whatever you want. It will do whatever you want. It is here for you. It's to serve humans. That's
one of my favorite skits from a Scottish sketch company show was where they got into an elevator and they had to tell the lift where to take them. And they said, it's AI. Yes. There are no buttons. Yes. But does it know a Scottish accent? Of course not. So they end up screaming at the AI.
There was a very similar situation in Doctor Who where the latest doctor is not Scottish and she had a voice activated piece that she had to activate. And she tried out some of her Scottish accents from the past in order to try to activate the AI.
It sounds like that the Doctor Who was aware of this sketch.
Yes, I think that that might be true. Google I.O., the developers conference, all the developers come together and talk about what they're doing, especially focusing on the security side of AI and what we are going to experience as a result of all that. There's
Minority Report, Steve.
All of the science fiction comes into play here. Every year at Google I.O., there's thoughts about all of the science fiction that's come before and how that innovation is driven by fiction sometimes. We talked about the flip phone earlier in the show. The flip phone would not exist without Star Trek, without Captain Kirk flipping open his communicator. There's no other reason for a flip phone.
All right, Steve, I do have something to mention. One of my favorite interviews was when Steve Ballmer, Microsoft CEO, was asked about the iPhone. And he goes, oh, $500 after discounts. Who's going to buy that? Well, guess what? Blackberry the movie gave the same feeling. Everybody wants the keyboard. People get this because of the keyboard. Mm-hmm. Steve, Google has taken a page from Apple and their introduction of the iPhone, and is introducing a fold phone with a price point of
$1,800, my friend. An $1,800 flip, but flipping sideways, a folding Pixel phone is coming.
Jeepers creepers, Steve.
Remember when I said that I was not on the bleeding edge of technology when it was expensive? This is an example right here. I would love to own this piece of hardware. I believe in the Pixel. I think that my Pixel, which is my third one in the series, is a wonderful piece of hardware. I look forward to this fold phone, but I will not be shelling out $1,800 for a telephone.
Well, if you wait a year, you can get it for $400.
If you wait 2 years, they'll be giving it away with a tank of gas.
Exactly. Steve, the iPad is also something that's still around and still finding its market. But Google certainly gave up on it for a while. But it looks like they're back in the market. Tell us about it.
And finding their market is the thing that I think about with the iPad all the time. I do not own an iPad. I've owned a few over the years, and I've never really found a use case for it. I love reading on it. I love reading especially comic books on it. It works really well for that. But that's a very narrow use case. I do 90% of my mobile work on my phone, and that 10% that I needed that iPad for is not valuable to me.
My children, though, use their iPads and the pencils, the Apple pencils.
For creating.
For taking notes in college. That's, they're being taught.
Really?
In fact, that's one of the things that they requested. Yeah, so what's so fascinating about this, where young people in school systems are using the Chromebook and learning how to use the Chromebook, when they get to college, interestingly enough, they're choosing MacBooks, MacBook Airs, and they're choosing these iPads because they're being taught how to use them.
For creation. That's the thing that bothers me about the Chromebook the most, is that my students are not using the Chromebook for creating anything. They are only consumers. And whenever they get to my class and I'm asking them to create, I've seen several students doing a Google search to find somebody who has made the thing that I'm asking them to make, because they are not creators. They are consumers with that product.
And that might change quite a bit, even with AI, because we're already having papers that are being created. There was a kid who created a piece of software that you can run something through that immediately will identify if it was AI created. The Chromebook, the reason why school systems use them is because price point. It's one by default.
Right.
If Microsoft's was that inexpensive, they would choose Microsoft's. If Apple's was that inexpensive, they would use Apple's.
Mm-hmm.
But they hit the price point. They certainly have all the things that are generally available on a computer available to them.
It is a netbook. It is that device that accesses the World Wide Web exclusively. It does not have any computing power to it. And that's fine for 90% of the day when you are just using the web for everything. But it's that 10% where we are creating things, we need computing power to do so.
So we have this Pixel tablet that's going to be, I'm going to say, reintroduced to the market. Is it running Android?
This is an Android tablet. It is, in my opinion, going to be not the replacement for the iPad, but instead the replacement for the Google Home that has a screen that's currently called the Nest Home. The idea of mounting this Pixel tablet on a device with a lovely speaker for good sound is where we're going with the Pixel tablet right now. I have one Nest here at the house that has a screen, and I like it, but it's not portable. It's not able to be taken somewhere. That's where the Pixel tablet really can be a dominant part of this ecosystem.
Do you anticipate you buying a Pixel tablet?
I believe that I will. I believe that I will buy one of these Pixel tablets at a reasonable price point and place them around my home like I had the Nest with the screen around my home. Screen size is important, and whether the price point matches the screen size is the only caveat for me.
I think what they are looking to do, and this would be Google and Apple and a number of other companies, is, you know, Apple, the Apple Home, basically to figure out a way to potentially make your home a smart home, mm-hmm. and then having something that's relatively inexpensive to mount to keep in a spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your air conditioning runs through it, your all your light bulb runs mm-hmm. through it. Any number of things. You can talk to it when you're away to, you know, lock the door, or unlock the door, or any mm-hmm. number of things.
And we've been working toward that future for a very, very long time. It's all about buying into the right ecosystem. If you bought into the Amazon ecosystem for that, you might be out of luck. That Amazon ecosystem is going away. And right now,
Have they announced it's going away?
They have announced that they are scaling it back. There's a huge scale back that's happening. Whether or not it will eventually it will go away. But for right now, you can still run your home with the Amazon ecosystem. I run my home with the Google ecosystem. You have the Apple ecosystem. And it's all about buy-in. It's all about your commitment to that product.
Well, it may not matter.
That was the geekiest joke you have ever used.
Matter is the software agreement that all these service companies have put together.
Yes.
Eventually, everybody's going to be able to talk to everybody.
Perhaps that's a possible future that they are trying to get us to a point where we are okay with buying into an ecosystem because it will transfer to a different one. DEF CON is happening this summer. That is the conference where they look at security and the idea of how we can protect ourselves. And they are going to take aim at all of this AI and think about how we can protect ourselves from the dangers that AI presents.
Where does DEF CON take place, Steve?
That is in Las Vegas, Nevada. So place your bets. Place your bets on AI.
Excellent. And do maybe you can gamble with it.
Seems like a good use of a dangerous technology. Let's put some money on it. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
If the AI lets us, we'll see. We would love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on all of this? Are you into noodling 70s bands or AI or all of the other things? Did you have a BlackBerry? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're still on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
We'll see you in the future. What I want to talk about. What I want to thank you for. What I want.